Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the, I believe, 11th show of Kicking It with Raphael here on World Football Daily, Season 2. Great show, as always, coming off Champions League last week. Europa League, of course, on Thursday, and big matches in the Premier League in the middle of this week, so we'll break that down later on in the show. Today we have four great guests from several different media outlets, Sports Nation, SB Nation, 442 based out of England, and some freelance guys who do ESPN FC and so on. But the first guest of the day, which has come on the show several times in the last year or two, my Barcelona insider and FC Barcelona La Liga columnist from SB Nation, Mr. Joel Cardenas. Joel, what's up?
Doing good. Just recovering a little bit from the loss. Hanging in there.
Yeah, I was telling you before we went on the air for the interview that I have a full show, but after I saw Barcelona losing their match last night, I immediately emailed you. There we go. And said, I have to have you on to break this down because two losses in a row. And I think last time you came on the show, you were talking about how they had not lost a match yet, and I think that was two or three weeks ago, and obviously the streak continued until Champions League play. Messi has gone down, I think, since the last time we talked. So, again, this isn't going to be the longest segment. It's going to be about 7 minutes, 8 minutes. But what exactly is going on? And before you answer, I suggest everyone should check out your column, which where can people check that out?
They can go to fcnation.com, and in the search bar, go under Joel Cardenas.
And just in case people don't know how to spell the website, BarcaBlaugranes.com. My favorite place to read about Barcelona, mostly from Joel, but other great writers. But Joel, like we were saying, what exactly is going on? Two straight losses. People are starting to panic a little bit, though. How do you break this down?
For me, it's a couple of things. One, I don't want to put this all, just for the record, I don't want to put it all on Liverpool because Lionel Messi is not there. I mentioned in my article that I wrote yesterday after the loss that there's a lot of people saying, we need Messi or whatnot. There's only so many times we can go there and keep saying, it's because Messi's not there. This team is talented enough to at least get a tie at Bilbao. Bilbao is a good team, but they are not a great team. So they lacked a lot of creativity. They looked lost a lot of times there. And the defense is not playing well. The only defender that's been playing well this season is Marc Bartra. And he's a kid that, will eventually be re-signed, but, was somebody who was going to stay on the bench if Barca would have gotten a center back this past summer. But, thankfully they didn't, because now we see that Marc Bartra has been good, and he has the potential to be great, and has been so far the best center back. But other than that, he has been disappointing. Salah had his injury, but he's been okay, but he has been the better of PK, and of course Pujol is coming back from that injury, so from the long-term injury, so can't really expect too much from him, especially at age 35. But for me, it comes from creativity, and that goes back to Tata Martino, and that's what I wrote in my article. I mentioned that I think that that's who we need to sort of focus on now. I think the loss to Ajax was, hey, Ajax is a good team, we can't deny that. And also, Tata Martino was not coached right before from the Champions League. And then when it came to this game, I don't think he was Tata Martino's out coach against Bilbao. I think it was more his game plan. He didn't have a great game plan. I think going with Seth Rodriguez at the false nine is continuously not working for Barcelona. I think they're better off just putting Neymar at the false nine spot there whenever Lionel Messi is out. Put in Pedro to the left, put in Alexis to the right, and just go from there. Seth Rodriguez, he is a solid player, don't get me wrong. However, his false nine role only works well for the Spanish national because the system, even though it is somewhat similar to the Tiki-Taka Barcelona, but it's not completely the same. Seth Rodriguez is going to stay in the midfield, put in Neymar up front. At least Neymar will widen the pitch edge out up there. Fabregas is not. Fabregas, that's not how he plays. He's more of a midfield, and I guess it's not his fault. You can't blame him for that, but I think this loss, Bilbao falls more on Santa Martino, and you know, yes, the players are the ones on the pitch that need to get the result. Don't get me wrong. However, that first loss to Ajax, okay, I can say that was more of the players. This one against Bilbao, that was more of the coaching strategy, and I didn't like the moves used for the starting lineup. And Santa is now, he's put to the fire with the media and fans, and we'll see how he deals with it the next week.
Yeah, I think something that's been interesting that we've seen both from Real Madrid and Barcelona the last few weeks is they've been starting to play some of these guys, especially in the Ajax game, starting to play some of these guys that are young that maybe nobody knows about, these 18, 19-year-old guys that have come up in their academy and now are getting some playing time with some of the injuries. And if you could just talk a little bit about those guys and which one of those guys, Joel, do you see standing out and earning some key minutes while some of these players are injured?
You know, for me, I think Adama has been, Adama was a young forward, he plays the right forward position. He has the opportunity to maybe get a fair shot at getting more time, not just this season, but also next season. Patrick, who played a little bit against Ajax, who probably, now looking back, maybe should have started studying Puyol at the right back, was a clear mistake. And Santa Martino over, I guess, believed a little too much that Puyol was capable of doing that. I think for me, in the long term, I think Patrick has a better opportunity to come in the first squad than Amada. As much as I do like Amada, I do think Patrick, with the situation, especially with Martin Montoya, who is right now at right back, he plays back of right back and sometimes plays left back, whatever Jordi Alba is hurt, or just not at right back when Dani Alves is hurt. Pata broke it down between, the club and Martin Montoya's representatives about signing a contract extension. And I honestly wouldn't be surprised if he does in fact leave. I know he Liverpool rumors are going around that Liverpool are very interesting. At Montoya, and Dani Alves isn't really going anywhere. I don't see him going anywhere next year. Maybe the year after that, Barcelona finally let Dani Alves go as he gets older. But he probably doesn't want to wait another 1 or 2 years, and I don't blame him for that. And if he, so be it. But that'll open the role for Patrick, who is an excellent right back and can play left back as well. I think he has a better shot at catching the first one.
Yeah, and he's 20 years old, and first appearance, I believe, for the senior team. He's been playing for a Barcelona team, which play in the second division. Joel, we have a couple minutes left, so I love asking this question. January is around the corner, 28 days from now. The rumors are, really picking up. We saw the Iniesta rumor to United, which we know is, just a silly rumor, but that's the beauty of these rumors, is they're very fun and exciting. I was looking at Bleacher Report, where you used to be, at some fun rumors. What is a fun rumor, something that you can laugh at, and something that you see seriously happening? So two different angles here, something that's very silly and something that you think will happen, a rumor that will solidify and will make a little more sense in the coming weeks.
I think the silly one for me that I keep hearing is the one about Iker Casillas, being interested in joining FC Barcelona. That's not going to happen. When I look at Iker Casillas coming for a place with Morales, of course, Iker Casillas is still, a good goalkeeper. I don't know if he's still a great goalkeeper, and, in fact, let me rephrase that. I actually don't think he's a great keeper as much as I look for the Spanish national team. I don't think he is anymore. If you can't start on your own team, you can't be great. You can't be considered great. That's just me. As much as I have respect, a lot of respect for Iker Casillas, I've always had respect for him, even though he is a Real Madrid player. I don't think he is great anymore. I think Diego Lopez has been better over these past year and a half, and that's why he deserves it. So Mourinho was right all along. But going back to the point, I don't see Iker Casillas ever coming to FC Barcelona. But one that I do, a rumor that I do keep hearing that could be possible, not necessarily for January, this is more for next summer, Arturo Vidal possibly joining FC Barcelona as an interim there. From what I've been reading and from talking to some people from my friends over in Spain, there is a little bit of
Thank you very much. You can check out Joel Cardenas at Twitter at @XOELCARDENAS. Joel Cardenas. Joel, thank you so much for coming on, and we will be in touch. Thank you. All right, that was Joel Cardenas joining us. My Barcelona insider talking about the latest news in Barcelona, what he's hearing from his sources in Barcelona. And what's going to happen with their two straight defeats there in Champions League and then a couple days ago in La Liga action. We will see what happens, how they combat not having Messi and other injuries. And you know, Joel was talking about how Piqué has been very, very not really playing in the best form. And Puyol is actually starting to look his age. So things are going to get interesting there. And the Cup is coming up in Spain, so maybe we'll see what happens there. But we're going to switch right now to England, from Spain to England, and it's my pleasure to bring on a staff writer for 442, in my opinion, the best football magazine in the world, which I get here in Israel, Jonathan Faduba. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of great stuff to talk about. You're on here to talk about the Premier League, so let's start off with the biggest news. You are in London, so Fulham have a new manager, a lot of experience. Dutch, of course, has worked for some of the great Dutch managers and most notably worked for Sir Alex in United, worked with the reserve team, worked in Qatar. I mean, he has a great resume. What do you think he's going to bring to this team? The latest reports indicate that he wants some money in January to bring in kind of his own, you know, new players. What are you hearing will be next with Fulham, and what do you expect with their big match against the Tottenham team that is desperate for some points?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was extremely predictable that Martin Jol was about to lose his job. It's been coming for some time. Fulham are in terrible form. They've obviously lost five straight games in the league, and they were plummeting, really. It just seemed inevitable that a change would happen eventually. Martin Jol had a bit of a downtrodden look upon his face that said that he knew his own fate. And so Rennie Meulensteen has come in.
Right.
He has a huge reputation based mainly on his success at Manchester United, where Sir Alex Ferguson gave him glowing reviews, particularly in his autobiography. He's particularly praiseworthy of the work that Meulensteen did. So there's big expectations on the manager, but there's actually been some reports in England over the last few days about some of the successes or lack of successes he had at Brøndby when he was manager of Brøndby.
Right.
There's been a lot of stories about the fallouts that he had with certain players at Brøndby, and you know, reports from players at that time that he didn't really grasp the stature of the club. And so there are some question marks going into the Tottenham game about Mullins generally and what to expect. You're definitely right in, when you say that he will want some money, I think, in January to spend. There are a number of positions that Fulham need to improve if they're going to stay in the Premier League. But I think it's really a state of kind of general malaise. They seem to have no real kind of enthusiasm or desire to win matches. I watched the Swansea game and they were really poor. You know, considering it's a home game that they could win, they didn't really seem to show any energy or enthusiasm. And I think that's a major issue for Mullen's team to resolve in the coming weeks.
Yeah, what's interesting is he's coming over from ANZ, which, of course, notable for signing Eto'o for that massive deal. And things have kind of seemed to unfold there. We spoke about that on our show. Eto'o's gone. I think Roberto Carlos left a management position. And, you know, the Russian league has been very strong this year. There were some interesting reports that I read that I was curious to see what you think, that this was something that was planned a couple weeks ago, and that Rene knew that he was going to be the manager, and that, you know, it was just a matter of time. Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, there has been some suggestions. I mean, he'd already left ANZ and was about to, or in fact, I think had accepted a position in Qatar, working with the Qatar Federation. So it was a strange kind of turn of events that led him to Fulham. Whether the contract in Qatar fell through, I'm not actually 100% sure what happened or if he took it and then was off, you know, became aware of Fulham. But he basically extricated himself from that deal to go and join Fulham. And obviously he joined as an assistant. And I think everybody, the writing was quite clearly on the wall when he joined that he would be the next manager.
Right.
I think it would take a great stretch of the imagination to imagine that he wasn't told that the job would be available at some point, or at least potentially available to him. So I find it hard to believe that he didn't know that, you know, Joel might be losing his job, although he has denied that. But you get the sense that Mullenstein does want to manage at some point, and did have some intention of managing a club. So I find it hard to imagine that he would have accepted a full-time assistant position at Fulham.
Yeah.
But obviously, we have to take him by his word.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I was watching the Sky News interview that I think he had moments after being, you know, named manager. And he literally was saying he was in shock. He had no idea that Yo was going to be sacked. And I was just sitting there saying, okay, this guy deserves an Oscar because this is absolute rubbish. So interesting stuff there. And going up against Tottenham, 2-2 this past weekend against United, important point for them. I think they could have won, but that's another issue. Let's move on, though. I think the most exciting game of the night, everyone would agree on, is United-Everton. Moyes, you know, playing against his old team. United right now, not in the top four, but they are playing better than before, despite having two successive ties against Cardiff and against Tottenham. This is an important match, I think, for United to get 3 points, because, you know, 3 points out of three matches for United is not acceptable, and even 2 points out of three matches if they lose tonight. Everton, meanwhile, top four in the league, in amazing form. Everything seems to be clicking for them and Roberto Martinez. I like Everton in this match. I think that they have enough talent to win. What do you think of tonight? What's going to happen?
Well, I think, I mean, for Manchester United, in terms of the expectations of the club, it's really a must-win game. I think the settling in period for Moyes, it still remains. And I think, in terms of within the club, I still think he has a lot of time for leeway and, you know, a lot of time to basically rebuild and settle into the club. But I feel that it comes to a point where you have to stop taking and accepting points in matches or, you know, minor setbacks and start actually winning games. I personally thought the Spurs game was actually a game United could have won and perhaps would have won in the Ferguson days, in the sense that although Spurs played very well and matched United for large parts of the game, I felt that it was a kind of game where a team with title ambitions would have sneaked it maybe perhaps late on and would have taken advantage of Spurs' kind of general uncertainty and feelings of, you know, unease around at VS Boas, and I think a team perhaps like Chelsea might have snatched that game late on. In terms of United, they now have Everton and Newcastle at home in the next, you know, few days, and I think both those games need to be won really if United are to be taken seriously in the league this season. Obviously, Moyes goes into the game behind Everton, which I'm sure will be a personal point of something he'd want to put right anyway. Let's put it that way. I don't think he'll be too happy to finish below Everton in his first season at Manchester United. I think that would be something of an indictment on him, really, and I think it would be something that would be majorly spoken about if he was to finish below Everton. So I think this is the kind of game that United really need to win now and to start pressing on, because while they might not win the league and they're 9 points behind Arsenal, they need to at least finish in the top four to have any kind of anything to look back on this season, really.
Right, it's important for them to make the Champions League. Another interesting match, Chelsea and Sunderland. Sunderland have been very inconsistent since Puya has been the new manager. They've won big matches, but then they've lost. But they're moving up right now. They're still only at 8 points, but when he came in, I believe they only had one, is that or three, or barely anything. Still in last place, but the things are a little more, I would say, optimistic in Sunderland. They have a chance to really, you know, help their what's the word, momentum, their morale, everything, if they can somehow snag 3 points. Obviously, I don't see that happening. Chelsea, I think, on the other hand, really needs to get 3 points tonight, because Arsenal has a very easy match against Hull City, though Hull City are coming off a very impressive victory over Liverpool. So this is the beauty of the Premier League, is you never know. That being said, what do you expect from Sunderland? Do you think they're going to do a lot of attacking tonight? Is Jozy Altidore finally going to score a goal? I know that's something a lot of Americans who are listening to the show want to hear you maybe say, even though it won't happen. What's your preview for that match?
Well, is Jozy Altidore going to score a goal? I'd probably say the odds suggest no. Okay. He's not having the best of times at the moment, and I think he hasn't looked entirely comfortable up front at Sunderland so far, which is a shame for him, especially after, you know, a successful season in Holland last season. Chelsea seem to have the sign over Sunderland. They've won 16 of their last 17 Premier League games against Sunderland.
Wow,
so
good stat.
All the signs suggest that they are not going to lose this one. But having said that, they Sunderland did beat Manchester City in one of the more recent home games.
Right.
So Poirier maybe might be able to just turn them around slightly, just gradually turning them around. But yeah, I think it's quite hard to really imagine them winning. I think a key thing for Sunderland, just looking forward not only to this game but the season, is if they can keep Wes Brown and John O'Shea fit in that central centre-back positions, I think that's a major positive for them. And I think those two have already shown signs of really improving the defence. Sunderland kept, obviously, a clean sheet in the last game, and they kept a clean sheet against Manchester City. So that's two of the three games under Poirier. The last three games have been clean sheets, which I think is really encouraging. And I think if they have that foundation and platform to build on, and if Wes Brown can stay fit, I think that's a major boost for them. In terms of the Chelsea game, it's quite difficult to see them really winning anything, but you never know. Maybe Poirier's got something up his sleeve and could pull out a win. Chelsea haven't looked impenetrable recently. They haven't looked incredible as they did under the Mourinho days of old. But it still looks like a bit of a stretch to imagine Sunderland winning.
All right, so we're going to talk about the rest of the games with our next guest. So before we let you go, Jonathan, this is always a fun part of the segment. A lot of rumors in your newspapers. That's something that you British love to do. Just a million billion newspapers every day. Different newspapers saying this, different newspapers saying that. Which rumor do you see actually possibly going through? What is there something that you've read over and over, maybe that you know from a source or an inside? Is there something that keeps appearing in the newspapers and in the media that seems like, okay, that's realistic, I could see that happening in January?
Well, I think if I had to... I mean, we do love gossip. Let's not deny that for a start. Yeah, we do love gossip over here, and you can find yourself a million magazines about gossip in England. But I think if I had to cast my eye over maybe rumours that might happen, I might look to Spain. And I can't help but feel still it's been a nagging feeling I've had ever since the summer that Falcao might end up at Real Madrid come February 1st.
Wow. Okay.
That's the... And maybe it's an outside bit of an outside call. Maybe, you know, I'm not sure if I might have to eat my words in a month or two. But I just still have this nagging feeling that Falcao and the Monaco deal, there's something maybe behind that. If you look to history and remember the great Hugo Sanchez, who played for Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid, there's a really interesting story about how he left Atletico Madrid and basically they refused outright to sell him to Real Madrid. And so he went to a Mexican club, and he was sold from a Bayern Atletico to a Mexican club, for whom he stayed for the grand duration of about one day before he was sold from the Mexican club to Real Madrid.
Hmm.
And obviously Sanchez went on to become one of Real Madrid's greatest ever players. Until Cristiano Ronaldo came along, he had the record for most goals in La Liga in a season, 38. And that's always been remembered how basically Atletico refused to sell him, and Real Madrid did a sort of shady deal and basically took him in a roundabout way. And there's something about the Monaco situation that I can't help but shake that same feeling, particularly in the sense that he's available for the Champions League, he's not cup-tied. He hasn't entirely settled in Monaco, really. There's been some criticism in recent weeks, and obviously he's carrying an injury. But I just feel that, I mean, Real Madrid still need a striker, and then there's rumours about Alvaro Morata now being loaned out to Arsenal or Spurs, and he's their only real recognised striker apart from Benzema. So there's this massive elephant in the room in Real Madrid in terms of what happens if Benzema gets injured, and why are they so calm about not having an extra striker? And I just put the two and two together, and I feel as if Falcao to Real Madrid could still be something that happens in the coming months. So that might be the rumor that I would look at the moment.
Interesting. That's, you know, it is very interesting when you add those two things. I mean, I got to watch Morata here in Israel at the U21 tournament. I think he led the tournament in goals coming off the bench. I am really high on him. I think he's really talented, but at the same time, he's not, you know, 18 anymore. He's 21, so he needs to start playing first team football. And I think I'd love to see him at Arsenal or the Spurs. I think anywhere he can go and play, you know, every week is a positive for him, because he's too talented to just be sitting on the bench. And like I said, he's not 18; he's 21. Interesting you said, because I believe the Monaco just came out with a statement saying they wouldn't sell him, but at the same time, that doesn't mean anything. We both know that.
I mean, Morata, like you say, is a really outstanding talent. We actually ran a piece on him on 442 recently, just, you know, explaining his career to date. And like you say, he was excellent in Israel, despite not really starting many games. He was still the top scorer, I believe, in that tournament.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he has enormous potential. And I just think the fact that he's been linked with moves away suggests to me, why would there be rumours about him leaving if he's the only basically backup striker to Benzema? And so, you know, they let Higuain go pretty easily. There wasn't really any real bid for Suarez, despite Suarez's desire to go to Real Madrid. So it kind of makes you wonder, like, is there just a massive oversight on everybody's part at Real Madrid, or do they have something up their sleeve, basically? And
so do you think...
I would suggest it's the latter.
Do you think that it was some sort of deal with Monaco that, you know, he would get them to the top, you know, two or three by January? And if he did do that, Monaco would be like, okay, you accomplished what we wanted, we're willing to sell you to Madrid. I mean, is that where you think it is? Or do you just think that Real are going to offer so much money for him that, I mean, how does Monaco come into it? Do you think, why would they want to get rid of him? For the money, you know, he helped them get all the way to the top after they just got promoted, or where do they come in on that?
I mean, that's an interesting question, actually, Rafael. I think that I wouldn't suggest that Monaco probably would have known or perhaps know about any kind of, you know, I wouldn't say that they would be complicit in any kind of deal to come in the future. You know, I think Monaco want to kind of announce themselves as a major European club, and I think Falcao was a major part of that. So in many ways, it's almost mission accomplished in that sense. If they can get in the Champions League, perhaps, which they're on track to do at the moment, if they can kind of perhaps even win the league, although that looks fairly unlikely, and with Falcao in the team, it kind of, they've already in a way announced themselves now as a major club, in the sense that they have the clout to go and buy literally the world's best players. So in a sense, that kind of job is actually already mission accomplished, really. It's only now league position that will determine it.
I think the thing
that makes me question this kind of the deal generally is the fact that Falcao turns 28 in February, and you know, he's reaching really the peak of his career now, and he hasn't really had a major, you know, I think he's not had many seasons in the Champions League. It's only really at Porto that he played in the Champions League. So I think from his point of view, you know, I think he does need to, before he reaches his peak, maybe he has one or two more years before he, you know, at his absolute peak, he doesn't need to be playing in the Champions League. And so I feel that it's something to maybe look out for, and We all know football's a strange beast at the best of times. So it wouldn't surprise me if Real Madrid did have some money set aside to maybe purchase him. Like I say, it's perhaps it could be a stretch of the imagination, but I don't think he's going to stay at Monaco for too long anyway. I mean, even if it's not this year, maybe in the summer.
No, I definitely. That's something to look after. Yeah, I agree with you on that, and you know, it looks like the French league's pretty solid this year. Lille and Marseille, and obviously PSG are the top four teams, and Lille got a huge win over Marseille last night. Jonathan, I know we went over the time, but it was a lot of fun having you on and discussing, especially this last topic. I think our listeners will really enjoy it because, you know, bringing in the Hugo Sanchez and comparing that's very, very interesting. But that's what you guys do at 442. You come up with all these stuff that we don't know about. So I recommend everyone check out the magazine. Also follow Jonathan on Twitter at JF Football, FUTBOL. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on. It'd be a pleasure to have you on later in the year.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. And anytime, yeah, it's great to be part of the show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, we're back here, World Football Daily. Third guest of the day. First on, we had Gilles Cardenas, our Barcelona insider, breaking down all the latest news from Barcelona, what's going on. There are two straight defeats. People are starting to panic. A lot of injuries. Puyol is really starting to look old. Piqué has been disappointing. And then we just had Jonathan Guba on from 442. He is a staff writer, great magazine based out of London. Now, the country of the show, third country and third guest, it is my pleasure to welcome on Richard Whitehall, who is with a soccer feature writer for thescore.com out of Canada, also contributes to ESPN FC, The Guardian USA, Howler, another great football magazine. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. A lot of great stuff to talk about. Last guest, we spoke about the big games going on tonight. So now let's talk about, for the next few minutes, some of the teams that will be playing tonight. Not specifically the games, but just their form the last few weeks. I think the first team we should start out with, Tottenham, 21 points in 13 matches. They got that tie against United this past weekend, but things there are not looking good. They're not in the middle of the table, but they're... you know, I think they're, what, in eighth place, ninth place, you know, nowhere near Europe. A lot of calls that if Villas-Boas doesn't turn things around quickly, he might be out of there. What do you think is left to do? Also, interesting to have you on. A lot of reports that Jermaine Defoe is heading to Toronto. So it's interesting to have you on for that. Can you explain all the madness going on here and what you think is true and not true?
It's hard to say. It's actually a former colleague of mine broke the story here first, and then was picked up by the Daily Mirror. Just an interview with the coach of Toronto FC and MLS, Ryan Nelson, talking about the possibility of picking up Jermaine Defoe in the January transfer window. It's sort of up in the air. The Mirror sort of reported it as a deal done, but there's been a bit of pushback from some sources here in Toronto saying that while talks are ongoing, nothing has been finalized yet. As ever with these things, sometimes it's best to assume that, you know, nothing's going to happen until, you know, Defoe shows up on a plane carrying a Toronto FC shirt. So we'll see. But it is exciting for the club, which has had a pretty rough last few years. And it's an interesting choice by Defoe if he ends up following through. So it should be interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting that I for one, was not exactly sure that it was a done deal. So it's good to hear from someone who's covering it that it's not. But with that being said, Tottenham have been struggling this year. You know, this is a team that wants to make Europe. Obviously, they are in Europa League right now. Their goal, though, I think for next year would be to make Champions League. They spent a lot of money on getting players from Brazil, Portugal. Do you think that all those players have lived up to the hype? I mean, they got a lot of money for Bale, obviously, and they spent a lot of it. I think over £45 million. Do you think that the team is playing the way they should be playing?
Well, it's definitely a mixed bag. You know, Eric Lamela was sort of one of their big, was supposed to be one of their big big name players, but he's only really been used in European play. We haven't seen him much in the league. It's pretty much now a conventional thought that Roberto Soldado, who is, you know, supposed to be the number one up front, he's been a bit lackluster. sort of definitely inconsistent. Scored a few penalties early in the season, but sort of disappeared since then. Christian Eriksen arrived from Eredivisie, and he looked like the real deal, and he's a player that I sort of really believe could be a major Premier League star. Unfortunately, obviously, he's waylaid by injury at a crucial point in the season for Spurs, so that's not going well either. The main problem, though, with Spurs is they have a terrible shot conversion rate. They've been taking lots of shots, but very few have been going in. There's a few signs that that might be improving, obviously, with the 2-2 draw against Man United, and it was part of actually a comprehensively good performance from Spurs. So there's some hope there. I think tonight is sort of they're playing Fulham tonight, so that's a team that's that's just had Mourinho sacked. So there's some hope there that Spurs can sort of get their goal count up and prove that their problems up front are just more of a matter of bad luck than actual form. But we'll see. And Villas-Boas, I think more than a few other coaches, he's playing a bit nasty with the press, and so that's just putting the pressure on him to put in a few decent performances coming in the December stretch. So Spurs are in trouble. They spent a lot of money to replace Bale. It's money that could have been put away, but Daniel Levy and Franco Baldini, the technical director at Spurs, decided that they wanted to spend sort of almost dollar for or pound for pound, I should say, for selling Gareth Bale to Real Madrid. There's definitely murmurs out of the club that the executives are not happy with the results so far. We'll see. It could be just a luck issue. It could be a coaching issue. But tonight Spurs have to do something big.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with the new manager on the sidelines for Fulham, and a manager that has a lot of respect in the Premier League, of course, being one of Sir Alex's main guys at United for over 5 years. Moving up now to a team that's been a bit surprising this year, Southampton. They spent a lot of money in the offseason. They were, I believe, at one point in fourth place. Now they've dropped to seventh, eighth place. Still, I think, 22 points. And from that, from Tottenham all the way to City and even Chelsea, it's like 6-point difference. That's a flip-flop that can switch. Why do you think Southampton have been able to play so well? Despite, I know they haven't played that well the last couple of fixtures, but at the start of the season, they got off to a great start.
I think it's really Mauricio Pochettino, former Espanyol head coach. There's a lot of skepticism when he first came onto the club, replacing Nigel Atkins. I think some people saw that as a risky move as far as, the point that it came in the season. Sometimes you get a new manager. There's a cultural barrier and teams can flounder. That did not happen at all with Saints. They posted extraordinarily good numbers towards the end of last season, and were generally overall outshooting opponents left and right, even superior opponents in some cases. And they carried that form through to this season. Obviously, they have some exciting young players. Adam Lallana for England is one. They're exciting team to watch. And even when they lost, the last result against Chelsea was maybe a bit of a slowdown for them. But I think the Arsenal loss 2-0, a bit of bad luck in that game. But if you look at the sort of overall numbers against Arsenal, they were matched them in possession, matched them pretty much in shots and shots on target. So there's a lot of positive things from this side, and I think obviously. Some of us were hoping that Saints could do something special, maybe be like an extreme dark horse for the Champions League. Those hopes are looking slightly naive at this point, but I think Saints are a definite definite lock, maybe for the Europa League. And there's a great article, I think it was a week or two ago in the Daily Mail, just about what Saints are trying to do in the Premier League and their approach to player acquisition and coaching in general. I think it's something really exciting for the league, and I think it's a good model, like Swansea was a few years ago, for teams that are promoted to the Premier League to maybe do away with the negative tactics we've seen under some teams, and instead try something much more positive, much more long term. So yeah, Saints are definitely a fun team to watch, and you can't always say that about the sort of minnows in the Premier League these days. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's true. About a month ago, people in Newcastle, we had a Newcastle guest on who was breaking down Newcastle. I think it was 5 weeks ago, saying this could be the end for Alan Pardew. Things were looking bad. There was no goals, no nothing. Meanwhile, a month later, 5 weeks later, Newcastle has jumped all the way to the top now in sixth place, so in Europa League right now. Their French players who are coming off that amazing game versus Ukraine have seemed to really pick it up. It's amazing how things can change, how quick things can change now. People seem to be taking back everything they said about Allen. Is this just, you know, a month of luck, or do you think that Allen has the guidance in the locker room to tell his guys, you know, if we don't change our style, I'm going to be sacked. You know, the team might be switched around. What do you think exactly happened for Newcastle to just be able to switch things around so quickly?
That's a really good question. I actually do a lot of work on sort of like advanced stats and looking at some analytics in the Premier League, and a lot of people you know, who do sort of, you know, the nut crunching professionally or not, were pointing out that Newcastle towards the end of last season and the beginning of the season were suffering some pretty bad luck. Their save and shot percentages were pretty low, but we know statistically that those numbers have a lot more to do with random variation or chance than they have to do with talent. Talent does play a part, but not as big a part as you might think. So Newcastle is actually doing all the right things on the pitch. They're generally out shooting their opponents, on a, you know, pretty consistent basis. But they weren't, the shots just weren't going in. And a lot of the times it just has to do with bad luck. And a lot of us were saying that Newcastle was going to, you know, regress this season and improve. And lo and behold, you know, like you said, a friend of yours a month ago was saying that Alan Pardew is like he's probably has 7 more years to serve on his giant contract. He's going to be there for a little while longer. What we were hoping is that the director of football, Skinner, wouldn't take the credit, and happily that hasn't happened. So I think Newcastle were always a good team. I think they were doing the right things. I don't think that there was a lot that Pardew needed to change. There's a very, very talented squad there. You're looking at a lot of first teamers for the French national team, which is, despite their struggle to make it past the playoff, I think is a, you know, an underrated team for sure going into the World Cup. So I think Newcastle is a really, really strong core of players. It's just now they face the challenge that a lot of, you know, most teams in the Premier League face, which is making sure they keep their best players safe from injury. So we'll see.
All right, and let's end with this. A lot of interesting reports coming out of Liverpool about, you know, Daniel Sturridge playing against Germany when he shouldn't have played, and Roy, you know, a lot of interesting stuff there. But we saw this Liverpool team and what they look like without him, a disappointing loss to Hull City, a team that's, you know, not in the bottom, and really not one of the worst teams in the league, surprisingly in the middle, but still, you know, a Liverpool team that I think before the match was in second place and has been playing really well. Daniel Sturridge has an ankle injury. He's going to be out for 6 to 8 weeks. You know, they might even make it longer just to make sure that if he really is healthy, or they might do the opposite, rush him back because they'll start falling back. And, you know, we've all read the reports that Suarez wants to be in that Champions League stage once January comes, so they secure his place. You know, this is interesting having you on, a guy who breaks down the numbers and all that. How exactly does this Liverpool team switch without the duo of Suarez and Sturridge shooting-wise towards the goal? How are they going to make up for that? Are their midfielders going to have to pick it up? We saw Gerrard score, so... what do you think is going to happen?
I think it's a curious problem for Liverpool. I think it's more of a tactical issue. At the beginning of the season, Brendan Rodgers was sort of playing around with a 3-5-2 formation, so, you know, three central defenders and then two wingbacks helping at the midfield. And the key to that was to give sort of Suarez and Sturridge, to give that partnership a lot of freedom. And the problem is, obviously, when you sort of build a team around two extremely potent players, and everyone got excited, of course, because, you know, it was a return of the strike partnership in the Premier League, is that if one gets injured, then the whole system gets out of whack. So I think Liverpool are sort of, they need to figure out what they're going to do now. Maybe give, you know, their younger forwards, well, I shouldn't say younger, like Aspas is 26, but, you know, they need to figure out what they're going to do. And I don't know that there's enough attacking talent. Obviously, you have Coutinho. You definitely have some players who can fill in that gap. I don't know if they can do it to the extent that Liverpool need, partially in part because we want to talk about stats a bit. Liverpool concede way too many shots. They can get away with that if they, you know, they're going forward, and I think that's one of the trade-offs if you have, you know, two wing backs as opposed to two full backs. But you're going to have a bit of space at the back. But Liverpool can't afford to do that if they're not going to be guaranteeing the goals up front. So they need to. Brendan Rodgers needs to figure that out sooner than later, because they're just going to have to deal with it in the next few weeks. And there's a lot of games coming up, as you and I both know.
Yeah, a lot of games starting off with later tonight for us, and I guess the early afternoon for you out in the States. We got to run, Richard, but where can people check out your work?
Yeah, they can go to thescore.com/counterattack, all one word, or just Google The Score Soccer, and all my stuff's right there. So that's it. Oh, and I'm at R. Whittle at R. Whittle on Twitter.
Yeah, The Score is awesome. Did The Score get bought by Rogers or by Sports? Someone was telling me that. Is that true?
The TV station did, but the digital company split up, and we're putting all the resources into our really, really popular app, which I recommend anyone who's into sports, into all sorts of sports, would definitely want to download. We have a great World Cup tracker, which is set to go live this Friday, but you can look at it now. So we got a lot of fun features for soccer fans out there. So check us out for sure.
Okay, yeah, The Score is awesome. Richard, thank you so much. Enjoy the matches, and we will speak later on.
All right, sounds good. Cheers.
Thank you. Next on the show from California, LA, Fox soccer commentator and weekly guest, Mr. Mark Serber. Mark, what's going on?
Not much. How are you, Rafi?
I am doing good and excited about the matches going on now. Big upset brewing with Chelsea and Sunderland. Last place, Sunderland, winning right now thanks to Mr. Jozy Altidore, first goal of the year. Sunderland fans have been waiting for it for a long time, and what not a better time than against Chelsea. So good stuff there. We are going to break down the four matches that you can't miss next week in the Champions League. And let's start off with Milan against Ajax. Milan have not won, or no, they just won, I think, their first match in about 6 weeks this past weekend in Italy. Ajax are coming off a shocking victory over Barcelona, since Barca were resting half of their team, but still a big victory at home. This is a take it all. Whoever wins, Mark, is moving on. A lot of excitement in this game. It'll be in Milan at San Siro. So who do you see winning?
This is a really close game to call, because first of all, AC Milan kind of reminds me a bit of Manchester United. They're struggling a lot in the league, but they really tend to pick their game up for the Champions League. It's exactly what we saw in that 3-0 victory against Celtic, especially with the way Kaká has really had a resurgence and the way he's leading this team. And it also comes down to what Mario Balotelli does. If the right Mario Balotelli shows up, then Ajax could be in real trouble. However, at the same time, you have to take a look at the way Ajax played against Barcelona. Now, the fact of the matter is, Barcelona had a ton of injuries. Of course, no Messi. Sanchez was suspended. Half their players were out hurt, and they were bringing up players from the B team. And even when Barcelona had a chance to get back into the game, they were bringing in the players from Barcelona B rather than their regulars off the bench. But at the same time, Ajax essentially beat Barcelona at their own game with a high-pressing 4-3-3, win that ball back within 5 seconds, and really put the pressure on them, and they were able to hang on with 10 men. And I think if they put in another performance like that against AC Milan, which I don't think is half the quality that even Barcelona has at the moment, then I can really see Ajax taking this one and really shocking AC Milan. I just think that AC Milan, they went 7 games without a victory before winning against Celtic, and then finally getting one in Serie A again, but they're just not where they need to be at the moment. I think that they'll make a late season charge later on, like they did to get into the Champions League last year, but right now I just think this is a team that's in too much flux, and I think that Ajax, if they can play exactly the way they played against Barcelona, are going to spring this upset.
Yeah, one thing that maybe Milan could be happy about is El Shaarawy is starting to play a little. He got 20 minutes on the week in the match this weekend. But speaking of Ajax, former Ajax star Luis Suarez has a hat-trick before halftime, which is pretty ridiculous, especially in the Premier League. It's amazing, especially after the defeat to Hull City. Oh, and the Sunderland-Chelsea game is 1-1. I said it was 1-0. I forgot about the score, but still Chelsea needs 3 points. But Mark, I'm going to agree with you on that, and I'm going to go with Ajax. Of course, big matches, Napoli, Arsenal, Marseille, Dortmund. Arsenal are moving on, but Well, actually, technically, they're not officially moving on, but they need a point to move on, and they should be able to get a point. Meanwhile, Chelsea has taken the lead, so the Sunderland 1-0 is gone, and now Chelsea are in control. Mark, Napoli against Arsenal. Napoli needs to win. It's at home. Excitement will be around that game. Higuain just had a brace this weekend against Lazio. He needs to step up his game. They have a lot of great players. Insigne needs to step up his game. At the same time, Arsenal needs to get a point to make sure they don't just get jumped by everyone. And on the other hand, Dortmund are playing against a Marseille team that's really been struggling in the Champions League, but has been doing pretty well in Liga 1. So what do you see here?
I think that Dortmund will definitely beat Marseille, because the bottom line is, as good as Marseille is doing in Ligue 1, they just don't have the depth at the moment to compete on two fronts. Maybe in the Coupe de la Ligue or the French version of their FA Cup, but at the same time, when it comes to the Champions League, Marseille just doesn't have enough players to go through, and especially with the demoralizing campaign that they've had, especially with what Dortmund need, I think that Dortmund takes this one. So I think it all comes down to Arsenal versus Napoli. Of course, Napoli, a very tough place to play. And then you have, I think, one of the best tactical battles. We talked about this the last time that these two teams met, between Rafael Benitez, who has won the Champions League before and who has made some pretty stunning in-game moves and changed the tactics in order to win games, especially against AC Milan in that 2005 final, versus Arsene Wenger, who's never won the Champions League but has plenty of experience and knows how to get really, really far in the tournament. As for the game itself, I think that Napoli has those players that can go on and win, all the players you just mentioned, but once again, Arsenal have just been flying as of late, and I think that if you have Jack Wilshere and you have Aaron Ramsey and you have those youngsters playing the way that they've played, and Mesut Ozil can run this midfield, then I do see Arsenal tipping this one on the road. And perhaps I see Napoli going out, despite the fact that they've been playing so well.
Yeah, that would be... I don't know if it would be a shock, because I think most fans would rather see Dortmund move on, just because we've seen what they're capable of. Of course, reaching the finals in last year's tournament. Another interesting battle here in Group E, Basel, which have been fantastic under... they have a fantastic players. Obviously, a really, really big name that has been on everyone's shopping list in January is Mahmoud Salah from Egypt, who's been able to beat Chelsea by himself twice. On the other end, Schalke, a team that is well known for making these runs in Europe when they're struggling domestically, are playing Basel. I always pronounce it wrong, Mark. We always talk about this before we do our interviews, so I apologize. But they're facing off.
You're calling them Basel, but you have time.
They're facing off in Germany. I think the toughest place to play in Germany. I think it's more tough than Dortmund. I think it's more tough than Bayern Munich. I think playing in Schalke, and this is from speaking to Germans, it's the toughest place to play. That's what's happening. Can they continue this run of beating, you know, quality top-notch teams?
I think so. I think that Basel have already shown what they're capable of doing. They showed it against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, as well as in Switzerland. At the same time, right now, I think that this is a Schalke team that relies on individual brilliance. They don't really have a discernible style of play. They don't really have a philosophy, and I think that that's something that Basel has. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is a Basel side that comes out and is able to take care of business. So I actually have Basel coming through on this one, where I think Chelsea takes care of Stella and they're going to win the group. But I think unless Schalke, they haven't really been convincing, whether they win or lose, whether they get the goals or not, they haven't been convincing both in the Bundesliga and in this Champions League campaign. And if Salah and Basel's players, like Streller, at the top of their game, then I can see Basel winning this one on the road and going through to the round of 16. And I think deservedly so for the campaign that they've had.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what they've been able to do. And it'd be very, very interesting to see if they can move on and maybe one of those, maybe be last year's Malaga that, you know, kind of shocked people at how far they could go. But I definitely think Salah will be in the Premier League, if not in January, definitely next year, because he's, I believe, only 21 years old, played under Coach Bradley, Bob Bradley, in the Egyptian national team, and really is a fantastic, fantastic player, and really shines bright every time he plays in Europe. Let's move.
Just to add to that before we move on.
Yeah.
The bottom line is, if Basel make it through to the round of 16, he's not going anywhere in January. He won't leave till the summer.
Right.
He'll only go if Basel don't go through. And even if they end up in third place and are in the Europa League, he still might stay just to play European soccer. Other than that, then I can see him moving on. But as long as they're still in European competition, I don't see him leaving in January. And I think that's the case with a lot of players that we have to remember. If their teams are into the round of 16 or they have a chance of going far in the Europa League, unless it's a World Cup year, they're not getting enough playing time and they need to move on, then they're going to stay so that they can continue in their European campaigns.
Right. Mark, last question and last game we'll take a look at. Galatasaray-Juventus. We spoke about this before the interview. Mancini is always, recently has not been able to get past in the group stages with City. That was one of the reasons that, you know, I think he was gone, that they sacked him. But huge chance here at home against Juventus, one of the top, you know, clubs in the world history-wise, to knock Juventus out and get themselves onto the knockout stage. This is a huge opportunity for Mancini in his career, and to prove the fans of Galatasaray that, you know, the team can pull off an upset like this. Drogba, you know, we've seen him do magic throughout his entire career. I just read an interview with him about this match, and he's really excited. You know, it's going to be an amazing atmosphere in Istanbul, at Turk Telecom Arena, the main sponsor of the team. I don't know who to pick here. I know Juventus are the obvious pick, but it seems like with all the circumstances around this that Gala have a good chance. What do you see happening here?
I think Galatasaray, first of all, like you mentioned, probably one of the hardest places to play in Europe. When it used to be the Ali Sinyan Stadium, they had signs up that said, "Welcome to Hell," and I think that perfectly describes what it's like to go into the Turkish capital and try and play against Galatasaray. At the same time, I just think that I still don't believe enough in Mancini. I don't believe that he has what it takes tactically to get his team through the group. I have more faith in Antonio Conte to make the right decisions when it comes to Juventus. I think that Juventus is playing very well, not only in Serie A, but they started to come alive a bit in the Champions League. Arturo Vidal is in top form, and I just think that Juve has more players at the moment that can get the job done. And this is a Juve team that is not going to sit back. They're not going to look at the counter. They're going to hit. They're going to push forward, and they're going to play their game just like if they were playing in Turin. And I think that that's something that Galatasaray might struggle with, is they're not going to be playing a team that's going to be sitting back and looking to hit on the break. And so even though Mancini has been handed three very tough groups in his 3 years in the Champions League, I still just don't think that he has what it takes to get it done despite the players at his disposal. And I think that Conte and the players that he has, and especially the way some of them have come along, not only in Serie A, but in the Champions League as of late, I think this one goes to Juventus, and it's another upset on the road, and it's the Italians going through.
And that is, those are the matches that everyone should check out next Tuesday and Wednesday. It's going to be a really fun week. Also, Europa League, a lot of big matches, but we won't get to that on today's episode. You can check out Mark on Twitter at Soccer Cerber, Soccer SoccerCer, Cerber SERBER. And you can also check out him on several media outlets and, of course, on Fox Soccer in the United States. Doing some work for these Champions League games. And that is it, Mark. Thank you so much for coming on. That was our show today. We'll be back next week with a lot of great guests. Thank you to all our guests from Score in Toronto, from 442 in London, Joel Cardenas, our Barcelona insider, and we ended off the show with Fox Sports commentator Mark Cerber. Thank you very much. Feel free to tweet me if you have any comments, suggestions, at RAPHALG23, and you can always tweet World Football Daily. And that's it. Goodbye.